From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a retired CIA officer's take on the rift between the intelligence community and President-elect Donald Trump.
Just about everyone who has some foundational competence to national affairs is gravely concerned about the utter incompetence and superficiality of our future commander-in-chief.
Also today, remembering John Michael Gray, one half of Boston's Hat Sisters.
This is who the gay community is. They were just out there like two exclamation points. World, here we come.
Plus, author Michael Lewis tells the story of two Israeli psychologists who reshaped our understanding of how the mind works and why it so often misleads us.
From my life story, I could build a narrative that my gut is great and I should just follow it. Because I forget the mistakes it led to, and I remember the successes.
That's next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Escalated into open antagonism. A potential showdown. Uncharted territory. That's how the dispute between President-elect Donald Trump and the CIA is being characterized in the press and by some members of the intelligence community. This, of course, has to do with Trump's dismissal of reports of a CIA assessment that Russia interfered in the presidential election in order to sway it in Trump's favor. Now, one of the strongest reactions has been coming from General Michael Hayden. He's former head of the CIA and the NSA. Here he is this morning. He spoke with NPR's Rachel Martin on Morning Edition.
This is just a dismissal of what the agency has said without an investigation of its data or of its analysis. That's scary that the fact-based guys get shoved out of the room before there is any argument. Frankly, Rachel, it appears because what they're concluding seems unpleasant.
So if there is indeed a giant rift between the president-elect and the intelligence community, how serious is that and what are the potential consequences? Well, Glenn Carl served for 23 years in the CIA. He was an intelligence officer on four continents, and when he left the agency, he was deputy national intelligence officer for transnational threats. In 2011, he published the book The Interrogator, An Education. It's about the crisis of conscience Carl faced after interrogating a suspected al-Qaeda leader for several months in two countries. Well, and Glenn Carl joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, how serious is the rift between President-elect Donald Trump and the intelligence community right now? Do you believe there's a rift?
Well, I don't believe there's a rift. There's a rift flowing all across the headlines, the pages, and everyone's consciousness. It's tremendous. But it actually is only a secondary issue compared to the larger issue of the competence or lack thereof of the president-elect with regard to national security and international affairs. It's stunning and an existential moment for the United States, much less the CIA. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, so tell me a little bit more about that. You heard the cut there from General Hayden saying that he believes Donald Trump and his team essentially are, in his words, pushing the fact-based guys out of the room. Is that what you see?
Oh, I see that absolutely is the case. One may make mistakes and get the facts wrong. Everyone gets 100 things wrong a day, and it's only the unusual person who actually can acknowledge that. But that's the truth. It's a sign of courage and self-awareness to do so. And it gives you the chance of getting things right in the future. If you simply dismiss things and assert facts that you wish and deny anything that seems to challenge your own view or your own self-aggrandizement, then you're dealing in what has been called an alternate reality. But that's too nice a term. Then you're simply lying and not living on the earth as we know it. It's a shocking development for the leader of the United States.
Is this unprecedented territory, uncharted
territory? Absolutely. Now, my personal experience goes back to President Reagan. But that means that I overlapped with colleagues whose direct experiences go back to the Eisenhower years, frankly. And there's never been a circumstance like this. President Bush, the son, did not accept many of the conclusions or like the conclusions, the views of the intelligence community with respect to Iraq or weapons of mass destruction or terrorism. But an argument is one thing. And President Clinton had hostile relations in his first administration with Director Woolsey. That's okay, actually, to have substantive differences. But when you deny even to consider the facts, and if any statement is made on any subject at any time with which you think somehow challenges what you view as your own self-wealth or position, then you're dealing in someone who is almost clinically incapable of dealing with the world that we all live in. It's absolutely stunning. There's never been anything like this.
So this is a pretty serious... You're saying some pretty serious things about the man who has been elected to be the next president of the United States.
I am. And it's a horrifying moment. Others have said that the United States is facing, and I completely agree, and I myself have said separately, that the United States is facing the greatest crisis to its institutions since 1861, not since the Vietnam War, not since World War II, since 1861 when the country broke in two. That is because our institutions... our procedures, the checks and balances, separation of powers, and the social compact, as well as sense of reality and facts on which we all have to decide what positions we take and agree or disagree, all are placed into question for the glory of one person's sense of self.
So let's bring it back down to the specifics of what this means for the office of the presidency and its relationship, or President-elect Trump's relationship with the intelligence community, because that's the area of expertise I'd like to hear from you. Because just yesterday we spoke with Admiral James Stavridis. He's at the Fletcher School now. He was former Supreme Commander of NATO in Europe, and he said that he doesn't believe the executive branch can function if there's a rift or a break in trust between the president and the intelligence community.
I think that's a carefully chosen sentence, and I agree with it. And clearly I'm expressing the same anxiety or consternation, concern, dismay. I could give an infinite number of concrete examples, but let's take two just to start. Let's look at the Pacific and the statements that Trump has made with regard to China. By repudiating, one can argue in favor or against the TTP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, but by simply repudiating it and alienating one of the two great powers, certainly in the Asian hemisphere, but also on Earth now, China, one sets a clash up that possibly could be avoided. It also means that we have withdrawn, essentially, from shaping the trade regimes, the economic policies, the strategic policies, the alignments, the alliances that have determined the security structure of Asia, which includes the United States, for the last 70 years. And that's done before the president-elect takes office. That's just on one issue in one area. I could go on for probably 5 hours. What has happened to NATO already is shocking because of the president-elect's associations and defensive comments with regard to Russia, because it is clear, independent of any intelligence assessment, that Russia's interest is to see NATO crumble. And by walking back from NATO unilaterally in a supposed declaration of national independence or some crazy thing, we have already weakened NATO. These are two of the pillars of the international order globally that rely on the United States as its foundation and protector, and already they are shaken. It is a huge crisis, and the Admiral at Fletcher is speaking carefully. Absolutely.
Mm. Well, so tell me, I mean, this morning General Michael Hayden on NPR said that it's the job of the intelligence services, of the CIA, to quote, in his words, get into the president's head. He said, we need to get our version of reality in front of the president, and we have to work very hard to make that happen. Do you think, I mean, it seems like he's saying he still believes that's possible. Do you believe that's possible? It's the CIA's duty, Michael Hayden's saying.
Well, I've worked with General Hayden and think very highly of him. He speaks from experience and concisely, and he's right on point. The operative expression for the CIA is that our job is to speak truth to power. And we are set up to be irritants, not to go along. And no one likes to hear that their hair isn't combed right, or that they've invaded the wrong country, or whatever we are supposed to say. But that is the job, is to speak independently, not in support of any policy, but attempt to present objective reality as best we can find it. And if we can't do that, then the president is left only with his opinion. And all senior leaders, and certainly all presidents, will be surrounded by yes men. Otherwise, they won't be there. So therefore, to counter that, you have the intelligence community. And we're essentially unable to function, which for the global
power— Essentially unable to function?
Well, if you can't talk to the president, how can you function? If you can't—if the president is dismissing any product, any assessment that you make— as somehow partisan or unwelcome and simply locked out, then you serve no purpose.
Well, you know that one of the reasons why—I mean, this isn't the first time that the president-elect has dismissed intelligence presented or asserted by the CIA. He was very critical of the intelligence community during the election as well. His transition team over the weekend put out a statement that said, quote, you know, these are the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. That WMD problem from the administration of George W. Bush does hang over the CIA to this day. It's the foundation of some of the lack of trust that I think Donald Trump is reflecting that average Americans still may have.
Yeah, it's a good debating point to make. It's also a fact that no one cares. You know, the details mess up an easy one-liner. But in the famous WMD report itself, 47 times the intelligence community said, we do not know if the following is true. 47 times. Of the 535 members of Congress, something like 25 read it, but they all had opinions on it. 99 times out of 100, the CIA will, on the whole, get its assessments correct. It is true that WMD we got wrong by reporting accurately the information that we collected. Even Saddam Hussein's own subordinates believed that the programs were continuing, which we accurately reported. But this is too much in the weeds. The main thing that's happening is a political maneuver to divert attention from Trump's comments and rejection of intelligence and professionalism onto a specific event that has nothing to do with him 10 years ago. That's, you know, sort of a cheap maneuver, but a standard one, and has really nothing to do with the issue at hand.
Glenn Carl, let me ask you, I wonder if your own, the particulars of your quarter century experience at the CIA can help us understand this moment a little bit. Because in your book, your 2011 book, The Interrogator, I mean, much of that book is about how your own faith in the agency was damaged in part because of the things that you were asked to do in the months-long interrogation of this then-suspected high-ranking member of Al-Qaeda who turned out to not be that. I mean, in the book, you write about how, you know, you were used, quote-unquote, enhanced interrogation. Others would call it torture. And in fact, much of your book was redacted by the CIA, and you put those redacted pages with the blank line, the black lines in it. And you put footnotes in there saying regarding some of the redactions. I just want to read one of those footnotes. You said, apparently the CIA fears that the redacted passage would either humiliate the organization for incompetence or expose its officers to ridicule unless the agency considers obtuse incompetence a secret intelligence method. I raise this because you wrestle with your own damaged faith in the agency in your book. What gives you confidence now that the CIA and its assessment of Russian interference in the election is one to be trusted?
Well, in a moment on the book, because it's relevant, I particularly was focused on or concerned by how we had gone astray in the enhanced interrogation program. Deep down, the book, sad and tragic as it is about a series of errors that we made, is a book of idealism about how to be an honorable officer, a leader, a public servant, and how America can get it right if we do it, if we live up to our ideals. So I wouldn't say it was a repudiation of the mission of the CIA or even its core functions and competence, but certainly on the enhanced interrogation program, I remain gravely disturbed.
So what gives you faith now? I mean, do you have faith in the agency now that what it's presenting in its assessment can be trusted?
Well, any human endeavor will be flawed, and all social organizations consist of humans. So there will be error, of course. President Lincoln was talking about a rival and an ally of his one time in 1861. He said, yes, the man gets it wrong. This was Senator Lane from Kansas. He said, the man gets it wrong sometimes, but his his eyes are turned towards Zion. He's moving generally and trying to move in the right direction. I think we do a little bit better than just going in the right point of the compass, but you have ideals, principles, you set good standards, and then when you err, you try to rectify your error, and then you continue to move ahead. Do I have faith that the agency attempts to do those things and on the whole succeeds? I do.
Two more quick questions for you. You know, there is an investigation or an inquiry going on. The Obama administration is launching one about Russian involvement. Do you think that the findings of that investigation and any congressional investigation, should it happen, should they be declassified and made public?
Oh, I think yes. You can always, almost always, declassify assessments and substance without revealing sources or methods. So the answer to that question is yes, it should be declassified. Do I have full confidence in the bipartisan, neutral, objective nature of a Congressional Oversight Committee's investigation? No, I don't.
Finally, do you think that that trust can be built between the president-elect and the intelligence communities, and what's at stake if your answer is no?
Well, the answer is no, because you know, a tiger doesn't change its stripes and a person doesn't change his personality and his basic worldview. And we have seen from the first day what the visceral psychological approach to interactions is of the president-elect, and that won't change. So he will remain egocentric, narcissistic, very defensive, and will deny, destroy, and attack anything that challenges anything other than praise for him. So that does not augur well at all for relations of the CIA with the executive in the Oval Office or the functioning of the National Security Establishment.
So how can the CIA function if it feels like it can't, I mean, it can't have any sense of trust with the executive? How can it function as an agency?
It's a critical question. And I said we are in the greatest crisis since 1861. Mike Morrell, a former acting director, a colleague of mine whom I overlapped with in my career, said that this is the equivalent of a 9/11 moment for the intelligence community. Others have called it the gravest crisis since World War II or facing our republic. All of these statements are true. This is a huge issue, that you have someone who lacks even a second grader's competence substantively, and the stability of someone who would last probably 4 seconds in an assessment by the CIA before being rejected.
Well, Glenn Carl served for 23 years in the clandestine services of the CIA. He left the agency as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He's also author of The Interrogator, An Education. Mr. Carl, thank you so much.
I wish I could say it's my pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's time now for the Remembrance Project. That's writer Alyssa Eli's look at ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives. And today, Alyssa tells us the story of a man from Provincetown, perhaps most remembered for his colorful headwear.
In his job, John Michael Gray was an arts educator in Newton with a PhD from BU. But in his colorful heart, along with his husband, Tim O'Connor, he was half of the Hat Sisters. For 32 years, wearing matching hats and dresses, they were fixtures on the Boston and Provincetown charity scene. John Michael's friend, Jonathan Scott, remembers the first time he witnessed them in millinery action. It was the mid-80s, the midst of the AIDS crisis. The gay community was raw with grief and helplessness. Provincetown was holding a fundraiser.
In this sort of fun party, I remember John Michael and Tim walking down the beach in these crazy, crazy sort of big ear Mickey Mouse hats, and they were draped in capes, and everybody just wanted to have their picture taken with them, and everybody just laughed and laughed.
In dark times, the Hat Sisters came to represent light. They became a constant at AIDS events in the 80s and 90s, sometimes attending 3 charitable events in a day. No one paid them. They did it for joy and solidarity. 2 stocky, mustachioed men in heels, smiling from under rhapsodies of tulle. The hats could rise 4 to 5 feet high and were often thematic. Gilding the lily was where they began. During one of Mayor Menino's inaugurations, they were dense with pasted photos of him. Sometimes there was history. One pair of hats held the Washington monuments. Another had towering copies of Boston City Hall. 4th of July creations, of course, came in firework tones.
I can just only imagine the, you know, the stitching and sewing and Velcroing and glue gunning and all of the work that they had to do, but just where they accumulated this massive amount of material. And I've been over to their house and I look around and you would think it would be covered with sequins and feathers and glitter and mylar and chiffon and Chanel and rhinestones. And it's like the most pristine house you've ever seen. There isn't dust anywhere.
After the AIDS crisis changed, the Hat Sisters broadened their reach and began to appear at rallies for equal marriage. They attended charitable events for gay and lesbian youth groups and for homelessness. It was activism without bitterness or anger, the kind of activism that puts its arms around people.
Everybody gravitated to them like this, just, you know, we were the metal and they were the magnet. And they would have hats of defiance and hats that just were really just sort of out of this world and bigger than life. And just said, you know, this is who we are, and this is who the gay community is. They were just out there like 2 exclamation points. World, here we come.
For 32 years, inseparably, they supported charities to roars of approval and unending selfies with fans.
I once asked them, I said, do you have pictures of your hats? They said, no, we never take pictures. I said, do you save your hats? They said, no, we just take them apart and use other materials. And they were very unsentimental about it. But you would be hard-pressed to find certainly a gay person in the entire Boston area who didn't have a picture with the Hat Sisters. We weren't unsentimental about them. They were our community.
That's Jonathan Scott speaking with writer Alyssa Eli about his friend John Michael Gray, who died in September. Now, you can suggest someone for remembrance. Email us at remember@wbur.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Best-selling author Michael Lewis is with us. His hugely popular books, Moneyball and The Big Short, can roughly be summed up as stories about really smart guys who recognized how to use data in order to overcome the fallible emotional wreck that is the human mind. Now, Lewis's latest book tells the true story of the 2 psychologists whose life's work explain why things like Moneyball and The Big Short can happen. It's about Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky and the research that created the foundation for what we now call behavioral economics. Lewis's new book is titled The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. Michael Lewis will be speaking about the book at the Harvard Business School tonight, but he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna.
So tell me first, how did you discover the story of the research of Tversky and Kahneman?
I kind of crawfished my way into it because I'd published this book, Moneyball, which was, you know, ostensibly about baseball, but not really. What it was about was the way the market misvalued baseball players, the way people, even professional baseball players, can be misjudged and misvalued to such an extent that a team with no money can find bargains and be a good team. After I told that story, the book was reviewed by 2 scholars, an economist named Richard Thaler, together with a legal scholar named Cass Sunstein, and they said, Mr. Lewis told kind of a nice story here, but he doesn't seem to understand that, like, the reason that these players are misvalued is that they're being judged, you know, intuitively by these experts, baseball scouts. And the baseball scouts have things going on in their minds that distort their judgments. And these 2 Israeli psychologists in the 70s and 80s explored the various ways people misjudged when they were dealing with conditions of uncertainty. So that's how I first heard of them. I never heard of Kahneman Tversky. I guess Kahneman at that point, even though he was a psychologist, had won the Nobel Prize in Economics.
But turned out he lived up the hill from me in Berkeley. And it turned out that Amos Tversky's eldest son, Oren, Amos had died in 1996, but his eldest son had been my student the 1 year I taught at Cal and be kind of one of my favorite students, and he was a friend. So I started to get to know their story and started to spend a lot of time with Danny Kahneman and realized that in this relationship between Amos and Danny, there was an unbelievably moving, sad, poignant love story that generated these ideas. And it was that love story that actually attracted me to it in the first place.
So tell me more about them, because in many ways it's like opposites attract, right? They were very different men. Their approach to, you know, how they viewed even the day-to-day work that they did was very different.
So the short answer to that is Danny, who was a Holocaust kid, he was I think 7 when Germany invaded France, where he lived with as a Jew with his parents, and they went on the run for the next 4 years. He was living in kind of barns and chicken coops and so on and so forth. He emerges from that as this kind of embodiment of doubt. He doubts himself. He doubts other people. He doubts his own ideas. He's kind of gloomy and pessimistic, a little neurotic, hard to get to know. Incredibly interesting. Like everything that comes out of his mouth when he's teaching is interesting. Interesting in the way a novelist is interesting. Insightful about human beings. Mm-hmm. Amos is born in Israel and raised to be a Spartan warrior. He's a war hero, totally sure of himself. The smartest person anybody's ever met. Dick Nisbet, who is a psychologist at Michigan, designed the shortest intelligence test ever designed. He said, the longer it takes you to figure out after you've met Amos Tversky that Amos is smarter than you, the stupider you are. And everybody who knew Amos said that was absolutely true. They'd never met a mind like this. Physicists met him and thought that he was smarter about physics than they were. And Amos was very clear in his mind, not neurotic, able to take ideas like the ones Danny generated and generalize them in all kinds of interesting ways. But it was an optimist and a pessimist.
Yeah.
It was a really neat person, Amos, and a really messy person, Danny. Messy in their minds, messy in their lives.
So what brought them together in terms of doing this research that really was so groundbreaking?
The thing that brings them together is actually kind of trivial. They were the two big dogs on campus at Hebrew University, and Danny invites Amos to talk at his seminar where he's teaching kids how to apply psychology. These guys are all in Israel. The academics are just different. They're intertwined with the real world in ways they just aren't elsewhere. These guys were all fighting wars every six years.
Yeah.
And Danny was very focused on like real world applications of psychology. And Amos came into a seminar and described what was going on basically in American social science and how economics and psychology had basically embraced the idea of people as more or less rational. The assumption.
It's a foundational assumption of economic theory.
Not that everybody is irrational or that every person behaves rationally all the time, but that to the extent they're irrational unsystematically, that it's an emotion or a mood and Danny challenges that idea. That's how it starts. Danny says, I think actually people are probably systematically irrational, that people are not like doing statistics in their heads when they face a probabilistic situation. They're telling stories. And the way they tell stories are warped in all kinds of ways. And so they started to explore that. But it wasn't the thing about this relationship. These ideas changed the world. They've affected medicine. They've affected law. They've affected sports. They've affected politics. But as interesting as the ideas were, and as interested as they were in each other's ideas, what it really was is how attracted they were to each other. Mm-hmm. They were straight men, and they saw something instantly in each other that just lit them on fire. And I think what it was is that Amos had always wanted to be a poet when he was a little kid, and he didn't have that poetic genius. He didn't have that. His imagination was fine, but it wasn't off the charts. What he had was an incredible. He was a logician.
Yeah.
And Danny had always wanted to be a scientist, but he was born a poet. And Amos was, you know, he was the embodiment of the kind of scientific mind. And I think they kind of finished each other's ideas and finished each other's sentences, and they They completed each other, I think is what happened. And they loved being together. They basically shut the door in a, they went into an office, shut the door for 10 years, talked to each other until they broke up.
Yeah, I mean, in part of the book, you write about how people could frequently hear laughter outside of the room where
Well, they're thinking they were. About, what is their subject? Their subject is human fallibility. And mainly it's Danny and the strange things they do and think as they move around the world. Everything is drawn from life. They aren't like theoreticians. They theorize about it, but the grist for their mill is war, people on the battlefield, people in politics, people in daily life doing weird things.
Yeah.
Danny doing weird things. The message of their work is that we are fallible. We're hardwired for certain kinds of fallibility, for certain kinds of mistakes. And so it's not shameful. It really isn't shameful that we should just acknowledge our fallibility and adapt to it rather than try to deny it. That's sort of the big takeaway of their body of work.
I mean, I feel like it sounds so sensible when you say it, and as they present it in their research, right? Because they're backing it up with experiments that they've done, but the message hasn't necessarily gotten through. We still talk about economics broadly in the same sort of, you know, rational markets based theory that we always
well
have.
Except they did spawn the whole field of behavioral economics with a flick of the wrist. It's one of the things they did, and every economics department now has these people who are trying to adapt economic theory to what is known about psychological man, about the man's mind. And the work has infiltrated government. I mean, there's psychologists working in government who never would have worked in government before. It was always just economists. Thaler and Sunstein wrote a book called Nudge about that grows out of Danny and Amos's work. And the basic insight is that people, when they're making decisions, they aren't deciding between things. They're deciding between descriptions of things. So the way you frame a decision can change the decision a person makes. So, for example, if you ask federal employees if you tell them they have to opt into their pension plan, they will save, 50% less or more than if you tell them they have to opt out. Governments around the world have already started to incorporate this stuff into the way they interact with their citizens. Businesses have incorporated in how they interact with their employees. Moneyball, the whole Moneyball thing. It's everywhere, right? I write this book about baseball and you have Moneyball for this and Moneyball for that. And why is that? Because people have figured out that in many places where experts are making intuitive judgments about things, the experts have their patterns to how they're wrong, and you can do better if you have data and analysis to at least check the experts and their judgment. That all grows out of their work.
It's got to make you wonder what their conversation would have been like had they both been able to witness the presidential election we just came through.
I can imagine it. I think they would have said Donald Trump is a byproduct of people's how uncomfortable people are with uncertainty to start with, how much they long for certainty, for someone who seems certain about things that are inherently uncertain. It's the opposite of what people should want. When they're looking for a financial advisor or a doctor or whatever, you drift into the hands of someone who tells you with total certainty they can do this or they know this. When things are inherently unknowable or uncertain and probabilistic, and you should kind of avoid those people, but we don't always do that. I think they would have said that Trump himself was really, really good instinctively at preying on the weaknesses in the human mind that they identified, the way a vivid story can completely shape the way people think about an entire ethnic group. If there was a statistic instead, if you tell a story about an illegal immigrant committing a murder, nobody stops and says, well, actually, we can go see if illegal immigrants are statistically more likely to commit crimes. And we probably would find out that they're much less likely.
Yes, but even when people do stop and say, here's evidence to the contrary, I mean, the question is, do people want to hear that evidence?
Well, that's the other thing. Danny and Amos were very interesting on this subject. Once you start telling a story to make sense of the world, you start looking for the information that confirms the story. Confirmation bias, they called it. Once the mind starts down a track, it's amazing how invulnerable it is to information that contradicts the story.
You know, the story of these two men is so detailed, and the relationship that you tell in the book. Obviously, we're only scratching the surface here, but do you think that, you know, their great discoveries, their insights into the human mind would have happened had they not been working together?
Oh, no chance. Yeah. No, it's a story of marriage, of collaboration. The things, their work outside, their collaboration, was nothing like the work they did together, and not nearly as good. It was interesting in its own right, but this stuff is world-changing. And they could not disentangle their work. They couldn't figure out who did what. The outside world wanted to figure out who did what, but they couldn't themselves. So it's totally a testament to the power of collaboration and how when you, especially improvisational collaboration, just like when you fully accept someone else uncritically and you're in a room just talking and the person feels that unconditional acceptance, how something can spin out of nothing.
Well, Michael Lewis's new book is called The Undoing Project, A Friendship That Changed Our Minds. He'll be speaking at the Harvard Business School tonight. We've got information about that at radioboston.org. Michael Lewis, what a pleasure to be in the same room and to just be talking with you. Thank you so much.
Total pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.